Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jemp and Luke Kupfer.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
This week, we're talking about organism origins and interplanetary inception. But first, we have a couple of YouTube comments.
Ooh,
these ones were on two different videos. Two completely different videos, but they are the same comment.
Oh,
from
wow.
The same person.
Oh.
Me watching the ad and buying the merch as fast as possible.
Oh.
Clearly in reference to our little ad that we did for our merch, which you should check out if you
should,
want to.
Yeah.
If you want to be looking pretty cool and smart, Jap's wearing some of our merch
right now.
I've
got the little tardigrade beanie.
Ooh,
it's very cute.
Very nice. And we have a question as well. Speaking of YouTube, head over to YouTube if you're listening on Apple or Spotify or anywhere else where you only use your ears and use your fingers and your eyes to answer this question for us. I have two questions for you. When were you born? And also, where were you conceived? Just curious.
In my mother's womb?
No.
Yes.
No.
Mm.
I mean, no. I
really?
I would say no.
Oh.
Yeah. I was born in 1998, and I was probably conceived in Durham, to be honest.
I was conceived in either New York or Washington, D.C.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
I would assume one of those two places.
All hail the president.
If I was born there, it'd be fine. But I wasn't born there. I was only conceived there. So today we're talking about, as I said, interplanetary inception. Do you have any ideas what that might be?
So this is going to be the building blocks of life arriving on a comet meteorite type thing?
Not quite, but close.
Okay.
Yes. So have you heard of Crick? You have heard of Crick.
I'm sure you have. Francis Crick.
Francis Crick, a Nobel-winning scientist. Watson and Crick may ring a bell to you.
No?
Okay, that's fine. So Francis Harry Compton Crick was born on June 8, 1916 in England. He studied physics at University College London. Really good place to study. Oh, pretty cool guy.
Oh, yeah.
I think the best people go there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Only the best, coolest, sexiest, and smartest people go to University College London.
What about the guy who invented eugenics?
Could still be sexy.
Didn't say everyone that goes there.
You could invent eugenics and still be sexy. You could be a horrible monster and still be sexy.
Okay, but you also said best.
He was the best at inventing eugenics. No one else could have done like him.
You can be the best at something. Doesn't have to be good.
Okay, the best at selectively breeding an entire race of people.
Oh, dear.
Selectively breeding out. And you don't need to breed them. You could just sterilize them or any other number of horrid things,
wow.
You know. So he studied at University College London, and then he started researching for a PhD under Professor E.N. It doesn't really matter who it was. Andrade. You don't know who this person is. You don't know who Crick is.
I don't even know who the original person
exactly.
is. Exactly.
So, yeah, Francis Harry Compton Crick. Francis Crick. You'll know him probably from Watson and Crick, the people that discovered what?
DNA.
The double helix structure of DNA.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So he started studying for his PhD, and he was interrupted by the war in 1939. And then
the
he worked as a scientist.
Quite a few people were interrupted by the war.
I think not. And then he worked as a scientist for the British Admiralty, mainly in connection with magnetic and acoustic mines, according to, I believe.
Mines?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know. This is from this is a brief introduction from the Nobel Prize biography of him. That's where this is from. Either that or Britannica. No, it's from the Nobel Prize. Anyway, he left Admiralty in 1947 to study biology. So he started off in physics and then he went to biology. And in 1947 he didn't know anything about biology, apparently.
Mm.
And he didn't know anything about organic chemistry or crystallography. Organic chemistry being essentially chemistry surrounding carbon. And crystallography is just, it's a sort of technique that we use in science to figure out what stuff is in stuff.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
You use crystallography to be like, this element is there.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, that's what it is.
Positively sick.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, bro. And so he then spent the next few years trying to figure this stuff out. Because if you're going to be a biologist, you should probably understand at least some biology. And then he was working on some X-ray stuff. And then he met Watson. J.D. Watson. Crick met J.D. Watson, I believe, around about 1951, or at least that's when they became friends.
Mm.
And I think Watson was 23. Crick in 1951 would have been much older than that. 35, I believe.
Oh, not much older.
Then 23. 35 is a bit, yeah. Quite a bit older. It's 12 years, you yeah, know.
I was expecting like 50.
Nah.
Nah.
Okay. Nah. Okay. So, so Crick and Watson worked together to propose the double helix structure for DNA. And oh my God, actually, no. There was there was someone else who worked on, who did a lot of work on the double helix structure of DNA.
The forgotten third brother.
It's a woman.
Oh.
My Rosalind sexism Franklin. Coming out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would you think a man would be forgotten? Rosalind Franklin. Yeah, yeah, so she did a bulk of that work. This episode is not about that, though. I just needed to put that in there because I know there's going to be comments saying, I can't believe you missed out Rosalind Franklin's contributions. I'm talking about Crick. So we'll move back on.
We're talking about Crick.
It's Crick Day today.
Everyone's talking about Crick.
So Watson and Crick, you know, did their work on the double helix structure of DNA. Rosalind Franklin also did some work on that. But that's not what I'm interested in today. Not at all. I don't care about Crick's work on DNA or helixes or any of that stuff. Nah, I want to talk about some other work he did with a man named Orgel. Leslie Eliezer Orgel was born in London on the 12th of January, 1927. He got his undergraduate degree and doctorate from Oxford University, and that's where he studied chemistry. I think both Crick and Orgel are from money, because Crick got money at some point. I was reading his biography, and he was talking about how his family paid for certain things, and Orgel went to Oxford, so...
Definitely from money.
Yeah, definitely from money.
Back then, yeah.
Yeah, back then. Yeah, there's no chance of getting into Oxford if you're... Dearie me, I love that our country is just so... what would be the word? Consistently terrible, I think.
Well, interestingly, Cambridge and Oxford just announced, or maybe it was Cambridge, I can't remember, one of them just announced that they're going to reduce the amount of places that they give to private school students.
Cool. Are they also going to change the policies that mean that you're not allowed to do anything outside of your schoolwork? So that you can't have a job or anything that is a distraction, meaning that lower income kids are left at a disadvantage to kids who have an incredible amount of wealth behind them?
I didn't know that.
No? Yeah.
I think they may be silent on the issue.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think I want to draw attention to the issue because I didn't know about that.
Are they doing anything to weed out the racism there either?
Maybe. Nah. I don't know.
You as a spokesperson?
Yes, sorry, I represent Oxbridge.
So it's just whenever they come out with these things, like, we're reducing the places that we give to the stupidly wealthy and giving it to the poor. Look at us, look how nice we are. Aren't we fantastic?
Oh, you have a silly job that's distracting you. Get out.
Yeah, you're still making it difficult for people to... You're letting more of them in, but you're not letting more of them stay, is the point. So, Leslie Eliezer Orgel was born, as I said, London, on the 12th of January, 1927. So he got his undergraduate degree, as I said, from Oxford, and then he studied chemistry there. And those two came together, and they spoke about this idea called panspermia. And let's talk a little bit about what that is. So the components of life exist a lot of places in the universe, and that led some scientists to postulate that life on Earth was seeded by extraterrestrial spores or primitive life brought by a meteorite. So that's kind of what you were talking about there.
Aliens.
So Crick and Orgel actually proposed that not only did life on Earth come from elsewhere in the cosmos, but also it was deliberately done by aliens.
Aliens,
I guess. I mean, it would be difficult to say that they were aliens, really, because then the definition of alien kind of breaks down unless you're just talking about something that exists on another planet. Anyway, the general concept is called panspermia, but when you're talking about someone or something rather being intentionally infected, a planet being intentionally infected with life, that is directed panspermia. So panspermia comes from the Greek pan, meaning all, and sperma, meaning seed. Mm. So seed all or all seed. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say the Greek. Ancient Greek, really.
Yeah. Current Greek.
Yeah, current Greek. The current Greeks just got... They got to it first.
They
got there. So... they proposed this idea of direct panspermia at the Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence Conference in 1971, which was run by Carl Sagan.
You're preaching to the converted there, aren't you?
I don't think so, though. I mean, Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence and aliens made us. There's a leap there, isn't there?
Yes, of course. But you're not, what I mean is, you're not presenting it at the conference of people who believe in thermal vents at the bottom of the sea. You're like,
yeah.
If such a thing were, what a conference that would be.
Very, very dry and boring conference.
Well, actually, very wet conference because they're at the bottom of the sea.
Oh, they're having the conference at the thermal vents at the bottom of the sea.
One would assume.
That seems like a wildly impractical way
Lots
to do
of
it.
Microbes. Living in darkness, so holding a conference.
They presented this at the Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence Conference in 1971, as I said, which was run by Carl Sagan, and it was at the Buraka Observatory in Soviet Armenia. And then they went on to publish an article on the subject 2 years later, and I thought it'd be interesting just to focus on that article today, because as far as I'm aware, it's the main thing or only thing that they really wrote about it. Is like the main sort of article that they wrote on it, and it's a pretty concise read. It covers pretty much everything that they're talking about, and it's pretty good. It's fun. It's a nice read. It's only about 6 pages long. I would definitely recommend having a look at it if you enjoy this episode. And also, if you enjoy this episode, we can delve into panspermia again and look at the sort of broader topic and all of the other stuff around that, because there is some interesting stuff there. I just thought this story about Crick and Orgel was just easier, just fun, to be honest, because it's just this one really, really concise paper. So, here is the abstract.
Okay.
It now seems unlikely that extraterrestrial living organisms could have reached the Earth either as spores driven by the radiation pressure from another star or as living organisms embedded in a meteorite. As alternative to these 19th century mechanisms, we have considered directed panspermia, the theory that organisms were deliberately transmitted to the Earth by intelligent beings on another planet. We conclude that it's possible that life reached the Earth in this way, but the scientific evidence is inadequate at the present time to say anything about the probability. We draw attention to the kinds of evidence that might throw additional light on the topic. So what they're saying, do you know what they're saying there?
So they're saying that the idea that the building blocks, sorry, that primitive life reached the Earth by being on or in a meteorite is unlikely because they probably would have been killed by other stars, like the radiation from other stars. So if life did come from outside of Earth, it was probably done deliberately in some way.
Yeah, they're saying that, but then also there are a lot of uncertainties, so...
Oh, and that there's no evidence whatsoever.
There's no evidence. yeah. So there's. They're saying it's possible, but there is literally no evidence. You know,
we haven't seen anything yet that suggests.
Which is fine. I think that's a perfectly fine thing to say. Here is this perfectly possible thing that could have happened. Anyway, there's no evidence, but it's a nice idea.
It's nice to be like, it couldn't happen in these ways.
Yeah.
We can rule out possibilities.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But it could happen in this way. There's just no evidence to support that, you know? Yeah. So, I actually think it's really interesting to talk about this in regards to Crick, because he's the guy that's known for discovering the structure of DNA. You'll be taught about him in high school. About in regards to DNA, and what they don't mention is that the bloke went on to then talk about how aliens made life on Earth. That is incredibly more interesting.
Like, there's so many examples of this where like a really eminent scientist also had some like flippin' wacky ideas.
I love it. This is the kind of thing that you don't actually, because we don't study scientists' work. We just sort of study the facts, and sometimes we're like, oh, this guy discovered that.
Yeah.
You don't see the progression of people's careers often.
Yeah, Darwin had some really weird beliefs.
Yeah, I feel like they'd hit on one good one, or maybe two, if they were lucky.
Yeah.
And just delve into madness. Just start talking about just mad stuff.
Well, that's the thing about creativity, is you're kind of like trying out lots of different ideas. Mm. And then the great thing that science did, if you have a brain that kind of fires off random ideas, that could be possible, that they have to be bounded by evidence eventually.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just believing in things that could possibly be true, regardless of whether there's any proof. So the great thing science did was it kind of created a way to crystallize. If you've got a brain that's firing off all these wacky ideas, some of them might be true, and then you sort of crystallize those ones into like a proper theory. Yeah. But the underpinning of that is, if you're going to come up with wacky world shattering ideas, you might also have a bunch that are a pile of rubbish.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me is that Crick, his thing, the thing that he's known for, I think this is what he won the Nobel Prize for, is X-ray crystallography. I'm pretty sure, as in figuring out the structure of a thing.
Yeah,
so it's very basic sort of. I say very basic, relatively
speaking. It's on the small scale.
What? Yeah.
Whereas, the space thing is... Yeah, the space thing's on a big grand universal scale.
What I mean is that you know, X-ray crystallography, or rather, sorry, figuring out the structure of the of DNA is more about just observing something.
Yeah.
And obviously, observing, inferring, there's a lot more to it than that. It's just kind of observing something, inferring. It's very straightforward. And then the fact that afterwards he went on to just make this hypothesis that the world's, all the life on Earth was made by aliens that sent it here.
Yeah,
I think that's brilliant.
I have a potential explainer for this.
Go for it.
So I remembered this in the depths of my mind somewhere, and I've just checked it. Francis Crick and other scientists did do some LSD.
Yeah.
As like, they call it like a thinking tool.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he thought aliens sent life to Earth in a little spaceship.
I wonder if that's why people get into science in the first place. Like, they have really crazy ideas, or they have like big, vivid imaginations about how the world could work. And so they have a passion for it. So they're naturally drawn into the sciences or something. I don't know.
It's really odd and interesting to me how, as I've said, just people will do something that is groundbreaking, can change sort of science as we know it, and then just stuff that is just it's like, wait, hold on, so was this an accident, or is the rest, which one of these is the anomaly, or are they all the same and you just happen to be right on this one, which one is it?
I think it's probably that. I think they're firing off theories and some of them will stick.
It's like when you look at Newton, who, you know, Newton did so much work. And it's the foundations of so much of our current understanding of physics. And then some of the other stuff he spoke about is just, like, I think he believed in alchemy. He was looking for the Philosopher's Stone at one point.
Really?
Yeah, and I think Nikola Tesla believed in, like, he believed in some weird stuff. He believed in, like, the ether, didn't he? Like the sort of spiritual plane.
Yeah, I think he did.
Or something like that.
No, and I mean, this is Nikola Tesla, who came up with wireless communication and transmission
before. He wired it through the ether.
Long before anyone else.
Given the idea from the ether.
Oh, from the ether. Okay.
And then there were these beliefs that he had. And then, Newton's writing suggests that one of the main goals of his alchemy may have been the discovery of the Philosopher's Stone. Bro was looking for the Philosopher's Stone. Also, like, creating, like, bloody laws of thermodynamics. Like, those, like, what's going on there?
Very different.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I feel like scientists nowadays are marginally less crazy. Because there's one reason for this. Science is no longer restricted to really, really rich people that just do it because, like, what else are they going to do?
That's got too much free time.
Free time and they got money.
Yeah.
I'll just do a science and education and no one else has it. So, like, they're at the top of the world with all the resources. Whereas scientists now...
They need to get funding.
They need to get funding. Like, you need to reel it in to get the funding. Unless you're, like, absolutely loaded, in which case... I think what we should do is give every scientist just a massive grant
to
do whatever.
Yeah.
And then just see what happens.
Well, it comes with their doctorate.
Yeah, I mean, they do that in like Pixar, for example. You like have a certain portion of your time allocated to just make whatever you like. Like, and I think that would be great if scientists like buy this drug. I mean, I don't know whether they do. Maybe in some institutions they do. But if in general you're employed in the field of science, 10% of your time should be messing around.
So we spoke about this, the floating frogs episode, remember that?
Yeah,
so that was that came specifically as a part of that scientist. I can't remember his name. Maybe
that
was
an Ig Nobel Prize, wasn't it?
It was an Ig Nobel Prize.
Could you explain what an Ig Nobel Prize is, please?
Oh my goodness, the Ig Nobel Prizes are kind of like the Nobel Prizes, where you get an award for achieving something, but the Ig Nobel Prizes, they're silly. They make you laugh and then they make you think.
Why are we so unenthusiastic when you
these are getting less enthusiastic and shorter every time you ask.
You're getting better, but you're also getting less enthusiastic.
Okay, but if you had more enthusiasm, I feel like you'd be spot on.
Yay! Ig Nobels.
So I think that was from one of the only people to have won both a Nobel Prize and an Ig Nobel Prize.
Yeah,
and he devoted maybe one day a week. One day a week, or it was rotational, so that maybe one of the people in his lab one day a week would choose just a silly project to spend time on. And it was the guy that invented, I think it was the guy that ran the lab that invented graphene.
He was just playing with sellotape.
And it was from a similar idea. They were also just levitating frogs in with magnetic fields. Yeah, so that's the that's ridiculous. That's what we should be doing. I think.
Love how you can set up the entire structure of organized science and funding models and ethics boards, and then sometimes someone just messing around is like, "Eureka!"
It's like, I made this amazing thing. Wait, how did you do it? I stuck some tape on some charcoal and I ripped it off.
And that is the birth of like what will eventually be like a multi-billion dollar industry.
Potentially by
humble
accident.
Beginnings.
Yeah. It's like the story of the guy that discovered or invented Velcro via biomimicry. I think the story is that he saw a bird get stuck to like a dog or something.
Wow.
Yeah, let me just double check that.
There's That's also so the story funny. Of how the glue on like post-it notes was invented was somebody was trying to make glue and they made a really bad glue.
Yeah. Blue tack was also an accident. Like if you look up accidental inventions,
they were crap at their job.
That's so funny.
Yeah, that was it. So
it comes right off.
George de Mestral in the 1940s, whilst hunting in the Jura Mountains in Switzerland, that's when he invented Velcro.
Yeah.
Because I think it's based on tiny hooks of burrs were just stuck on his trousers. He was like, wow. These plants have stuck to me. Let's make clothes from it. Like, it's so many inventions are scientists seeing something in nature and then copying it.
Yeah.
We call it, I think, biomimicry, which is a really great way to say, I stole it, but from nature.
Plagiarism from nature.
Yeah. And I saw a gecko doing this thing, and I fully just ripped it off.
That bird really should have done a patent.
That's my idea now, bro. That's my idea now, bro. Yeah, so lots of inventions are very, very silly. Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
It sure is.
It is.
What are we advertising today? Well, I'll tell you what it is.
Please.
It's After Dark. I say brand new, it's our super secret, very special, exclusive show. Just because SciGuys has ended, it doesn't mean the conversation has. Why don't you let them know what After Dark is, guys?
It's basically an opportunity for us to talk on a wider range of topics. You might see in SciGuys occasionally we go on little tangents. Well, After Dark is one gigantic tangent where we talk about a subject and then the conversation kind of meanders, but then we try to create a holistic lesson or message at the end of the show.
Yeah, we were finding these tangents were happening anyway throughout the show. Some of them were a bit too long for a single episode, so we thought, you know, why not? Why don't we make a whole new podcast where we do just that?
So if your favorite part of SciGuys is the tangents, then absolutely you need to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/SciGuys, the only place you can access After Dark. And as I said, just because SciGuys has ended, it doesn't mean the conversation has.
But it's a super secret show, so don't tell anybody. Shh.
No, tell everybody.
But don't tell anyone.
We want everyone to know.
No, don't do that.
It's super secret, but we want everyone to know.
Tell everyone. Tell everyone about this. Okay, let's just start the show. But getting back to Panspermia, here's the introduction to the paper. It was not until the middle of the 19th century that Pasteur and Tyndall completed the demonstration that spontaneous generation is not occurring on Earth nowadays. Darwin and a number of other biologists concluded that life must have evolved here long ago when conditions were more favorable. A number of scientists, however, drew a quite different conclusion. They supposed that if life does not evolve from terrestrial non-living matter nowadays, it may never have done so. Hence, they argued, life reached Earth as an infection from another planet.
Ooh.
So, essentially, what they're saying there is, yeah, look, people have said that life would have spontaneously arisen, maybe back when there was like a nice little biological soup for life to arise in. It doesn't happen now, but other people are saying that if it doesn't happen now, then it could never have happened. And so it must have happened somewhere else, which, you know, they go on to talk about the other ideas, like other people's ideas on the topic, and then highlight that spores and even radiation-resistant spores would have had such high dose whilst traveling through the universe that they would have just become unviable and then unable to see life on any new planet they landed on. And then they also mentioned, I think, as we've mentioned this in the abstract, about how meteorites and how the chances of an extrasolar meteorite hitting the Earth are so low that we don't even think one has ever hit the surface of the Earth. At least that's the Carl Sagan quote. It's unlikely that a single meteorite of extrasolar origin has ever reached the surface of the Earth, Carl Sagan. And as far as I'm aware, we still believe this. We don't think that anything from outside of our solar system has hit the planet, which is mad.
Damn.
I mean, I say it's mad. It kind of makes sense. I feel like we just don't think about how big our solar system is.
Could we possibly?
I don't know. I can't think about how big the Earth is. It's curved? Nah, it doesn't look curved.
No,
it looks how could it be so big that I'm looking at it and it looks flat?
I'm not convinced.
But it's actually round. Mental.
Maybe it's not big. Maybe you're small.
Yeah, but still. How could I be so small? You know?
It's impossible.
Yeah, I don't. I'm a very big guy. I'm a big guy.
What are you calling me small for?
I'm very big. I'm not small.
Well, you're bigger than me.
Yeah.
But we're both small.
I don't know. I feel like the earth is too big. I don't trust it. You know, it's up to something, man. It's up to something. What's it being that big for?
It's really going about sustaining your entire life.
Yeah, and I don't want that. Oh, I never asked for that. That's you know, I never asked for that. The earth should stop sustaining life without my consent. So, as I was saying, in the first few paragraphs of their paper, they talk about how life on Earth couldn't have been coincidentally seeded by spores or meteors, and so their conclusion is that something must have done it intentionally, or rather that intentional infection seems rather more likely than those other two options. And so the paper goes on to discuss the idea of passing the buck, which is kind of a criticism that I had. Panspermia, and really panspermia in general, doesn't solve the problem of how life on Earth began. It just shifts it to
another
planet.
Where did that life come from?
It came from another... Look, life doesn't begin from not life here, but maybe somewhere else.
It's like the issue of like God being the answer to the creation of the universe. It's just shifting the problem back.
What you've done... This is what really bugs me about God. Well, one of the many... one of the long list of many things.
Wow, you got an issue with God, man?
Yeah.
He's got an issue with you now.
God's always had an issue with me.
Oh, okay.
So, I just feel that when people say... You don't like how did the universe come from nothing? You know, how did the Big Bang happen from nothing? One, I mean, it's probably more complex than you think it is. It's been simplified for you in school.
There was probably something before the Big Bang.
Yeah, they teach the Big Bang to children. So maybe you're getting a children's explanation rather than a top level physicist explanation. Mm. But that's besides the point. When they say how could something come from nothing? The universe had to come from somewhere. I think the universe came from God. Where's God coming from?
He was always there.
But that's it. Then they just make up a new rule where they're like, well, yeah, God is all-knowing and all-being.
He's
and
eternal.
Omnipotent and has always existed. You haven't solved the problem. You've changed the rules of the bloody game.
But how does that happen?
It's a nice sort of mental trick to sort of fill in the scary gap.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
And that's what, look, I have no issue with people believing in God and, you know, not harming anyone else or whatever, or indoctrinating kids or, you know, chopping bits off of them or anything like that. That's all good with me. If you want to believe in God, go ahead. You have my permission. Wow, I give it to you. Yeah, very kind to me. So go ahead and believe in God. But if you're going to stand up to scientists and say, "Pah, your idea is stupid. My idea works," because you've made up the rules of your idea. Scientists are trying to play within the rules of the universe as they have observed them.
Yeah.
And you're saying, no, actually, your explanation is dumb because you've not made up your own rules like I have that explains everything.
Yeah.
This is why, obviously, religion is just a different lens through which one can view the world.
Yeah.
The reason that I often find it a less than favorable lens is that it tends to know everything, you know? It tends to have an explanation for everything. Whereas science is always like, oh, we don't know this, and oh, we may be wrong about that. Religion often seems to just have...
Has lots of answers, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of rules, lots of answers, but no explanations.
Yeah. The explanations often boil down to, well, because...
But
that's the way it is.
Just because.
That
just
is
because.
True.
Yeah.
It is true.
It is.
Because God.
Yeah. Why does God let kids get bone cancer and die?
God works in mysterious ways.
Do you think you could understand God's mind?
How dare you try and claim that you can understand God's grand plan?
I mean, I guess. I guess you have set up a situation wherein I have no retort because they've essentially done that thing. Have you ever played like a game with a sibling or a friend when you were a kid, and you're with one of those just little bastards that change the rules?
Yeah. And they're about to lose.
Oh, my cousin does this all the time.
Exactly.
I just stop it.
And you're just like, hey,
not fun to play with.
The cousin that I met at your wedding, the adult cousin.
No. Yes. My adult cousin Anna.
To this day.
Older than me.
She does this?
Just
what?
Changes the rules in
That's
every
so
game.
Weird.
Man. No, my little baby cousin. When we play table football, she just goes, no. And then changes something and then she wins. Aww. And I go, oh, no, I've lost.
Aww. See, if that were to happen to me, I'd be like, hey, kid, it's not how the real world works. You lost. Yeah. Deal with it. You know?
Well, life will teach her eventually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm, or. Yeah.
Oh, she's going to learn.
Or she'll become a tyrant.
One or of perhaps those two. A priest. No. You know.
Oh, dear.
Largely the same thing. The joke. Mm. It's just a little joke. Oof. It's just a little joke. Oh, I'm sorry. Are priests above reproach Oof. Here? Oof. Are priests above reproach?
Priests are above reproach with a certain portion of the population who really like priests.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm not a portion of that population. Yeah.
Priest lovers love priests.
So, obviously, panspermia just does that kind of... the whole sort of God problem, where it says, you have a problem? It's no longer a problem. This and actually the what answer. They've done is just swept it under the rug or you know, pushed it off to the side and said, actually, no, the problem is someone else's problem to solve.
Could it be argued that it widens the probability? Like, so like if something's really unlikely, if you widen it to every possible planet, I know it's a bit of mathematical trickery, but it is more likely that life occurred on a planet somewhere than it is that it occurred on our planet because there's more planets.
Okay. So it would be more likely for life to occur on any planet somewhere that could sustain life than the probability of life starting specifically on our planet.
Yeah.
As far as we're aware, right? That's assuming that all of the conditions are equal and they're all equal probabilities based on set conditions, which we don't actually know. However, we are in a situation where life is on Earth, and so the probability, that's irrelevant. That is honestly... It pretty much entirely... Oh, God, it's going to be mathematicians in the comments. It's irrelevant, right? Okay. Because we don't need to be sitting here thinking, oh, what's the probability of it? It's on this planet. That is where it is.
Right.
So
that's a given.
Yeah. Hmm. So we're trying to... And there are a lot of assumptions that come with saying that by widening out that probability, you know?
Yeah.
Because those planets don't have life, as far as we're aware. Mm.
Yeah.
And so...
interesting, yeah.
In that sense, it's a tough one. It's kind of not necessary. So they do have a retort to this. So Crick and Ogle's retort is pretty basic and steeped in hypotheticals, in my opinion. Not that I don't like hypotheticals. Don't get me wrong. I love me a good hypothetical. I just think sometimes maybe a hypothetical isn't the best defense of your argument. Mm. So,
hypothetically speaking.
Hypothetically speaking, of course, yeah. One could imagine a situation wherein a hypothetical would be a poor defense of your argument. And here is one. It's also been argued that infective theories of origins of terrestrial life should be rejected because they do no more than transfer the problem of origins to another planet.
Mm.
This view is mistaken. The historical facts are important in their own right. For all we know, there may have been other types of planet on which the origin of life, ab initio, is greatly more probable than on our own. For example, such a planet may possess a mineral or compound of crucial catalytic importance, which is rare on Earth. It is thus important to know whether primitive organisms evolved here or whether they arrived from somewhere else. Here, we re-examine this problem in the light of more recent biological and astronomical information. What they're saying is, so you say that we're passing the buck, but actually it's very important, because if it did start on another planet, if life started on another planet, it might make more sense if there was something there, something special, that could have helped life along. Because right now we've got a problem. We've spoken about this in our Life in a Jar episode. We know we can assume some of the starting positions of conditions of Earth, you know, before life sort of started and what was going around there. But actually getting life to start from that, it's tough. I mean, theoretically, you could potentially do it with enough time, I guess. But the idea of how life actually started from not life is a tough one because a lot of conditions need to be kind of correct, and you need these molecules to form, or you need DNA code to form. Like, there's different ideas which we spoke about in the Life in the Jar episode, whether it was nucleotides, like bases of DNA code, kind of started first, or whether I think it was more the sort of chemical processes, like you know, almost metabolic processes that started first. It's very complicated, but essentially what they're saying here is that knowing where life started is important because if it started on another planet, it might have been much easier for life to start, and that's why life started. Because back then, one of the main problems is it seems so unlikely for life to have started on this planet. So how did it actually start, sort of thing?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of feels like this is just a probabilistic argument
kind of
put into a story.
Yeah.
It's like they've just taken mathematical laws of probability And then they've gone, and then they've put on top of it, like, characters, like planets and metabolic processes or like individual chemicals and stuff. And it's really just a probabilistic argument that could kind of be applied to anything where there's higher probabilities and lower probabilities of things happening.
Yeah, and the key point here is that a lot of these probabilities are assumed or hypothetical.
Yeah, because so there's no data.
Yeah, so when they're saying, well, what if there's a hypothetical planet where there's some hypothetical mineral, which is an amazing catalyst for, you know, taking abiotic material and turning them into biotic materials.
But these are all like cognitive distortions. It's kind of like what ifs.
Exactly. You know, it's like it is exactly like just a what if. Like, what if this was were the case? If that were the case, then yes, I suppose you would be right. Is that the case? I don't know. But what if it was?
Yeah.
And so they're talking about what ifs, and then they go on to talk about their current knowledge of the galaxy, which of course is now almost 50 years out of date, 49 years out of date. So yeah. I'm not going to dwell too long on it because I don't know what's changed in the past 49 years. I wasn't alive for most of those. So here is this just absolute belter of a paragraph. We know that not much more than 4×10⁹ years has elapsed between the appearance of life on Earth, wherever it came from, and the development of our own technology.
Just getting that in there.
Sorry.
Get that in there.
Ooh. Like, ooh, we don't know. Like, not necessary, guys. Not necessary. I love.
Just to remind you.
But we. Ooh, what if? Who knows? We know that not much more than 4×10⁹ years. What is that? That'd be 4 billion.
About 4 billion.
Yeah. We know that not much more than 4 billion years has elapsed between the appearance of life on Earth, wherever it came from, and the development of our own technological society. The time available makes it possible, therefore, that technological societies existed elsewhere in the galaxy, even before the formation of Earth. We should, therefore, consider a new infective theory, namely that a primitive form of life was deliberately planted on Earth by a technologically advanced society on another planet. So what they've done is they've led us through it. They've said, okay, now some people are saying that life came from other planets. That doesn't make no sense. That doesn't make any sense because it would have died. Okay? But life is, maybe it didn't start on Earth. And if it didn't start on Earth, but it can't have just traveled by itself to Earth, what could it have been? Aliens.
But that kind of like, is it the Fermi paradox? The where are all the aliens thing?
Yeah.
So that, but that kind of like, you're invoking as part of your probability that something more advanced than us.
As advanced.
Well, but we've not done this. We've not seeded life to other planets.
It's technically possible for us to.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. But also, something more advanced than us, a long time ago, so that the seed has had time to propagate across the solar system and probably between solar systems, exists that we don't have any evidence for. It's not to say that something more advanced than us couldn't exist. It's just that that's another improbability.
To be fair, 4 billion years... if a civilization could live and die in 4 billion years, conceivably, you know? I mean, it's, if you talk about the Great Filter, there's this idea of why aren't there any... like it's one of the sort of solutions for the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox being there are however many planets and solar systems and stars and all of that nonsense out in the universe. So where are all of the other sort of life forms, like where are the aliens essentially? Because if there are all of those planets and the chance are some of them need to be capable of sort of sustaining life, so where is it? And there are different answers. You know, there's the idea of the Great Filter, wherein at some point civilizations just sort of, you know, will cease to exist because they get too large or they collapse in on themselves, something like that. And there's two options: either we are before the Great Filter or we're after the Great Filter. So whatever whatever the bottleneck is where most civilizations completely collapse, we've either passed it, which is a good thing, in the sense that our society, our entire the human race is not going to reach some sort of a bottleneck wherein it destroys itself. So that's good on that front. But also it means that we're probably alone in the universe because everything else has been caught in that filter. Or the filter is coming up ahead. In which case, oh boy.
An example of one of those filters might be, for example, the discovery of, like, understanding nuclear fission and fusion.
Yeah.
Because you destroy, most societies eventually destroy themselves once they've sort of harnessed nuclear energy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing most societies could do.
Yeah. Which, to be honest, this is one thing that I find difficult. We're going to talk about this later. I really bloody hate the way that we talk about things like this. It pisses me off to no end because we talk about it from a very human perspective.
Mm.
Oh, what if societies will destroy themselves with wars? And maybe war is a human thing. Huh? Maybe okay. War is a human thing. You know? Like, what if this? What if that? Maybe if another species was going to exist, capitalism wouldn't exist. Maybe the concept of an economic system is so foreign to them that it's not even relevant in discussion.
Yeah.
We inherently view all of these hypothetical societies, alien societies, through a distinctly human lens.
Yeah.
And we can't seem to break out of that. And it bothers me because it's our conception of what a society could be. And it's just, I don't know, it feels short-sighted to say the least.
Yeah, I think because a lot of people assume their perception of the world and how the world works is like an unquestionable fact of how the universe works. And so if aliens exist, they must also think similar to us.
Well, but surely that sort of thinking whereby you say, well, maybe other planets don't have sort of fighting between different groups, for example. And it's very possible we could evolve towards a state whereby we cooperate and manage to separate our differences. But we don't know of any species that... that are sentient and able to sort of make things that haven't evolved by natural selection. And natural selection necessarily involves at least some competition between rivals, even if it's competition for resources as opposed to competition with each other. So it to a certain extent, invoking a thing that we don't have any evidence for, potentially.
Yeah, although very probable. But then the idea that natural selection inherently leads to war, I think, is not... I don't know if that quite works. I mean, yeah, you do see some similar stuff between ants and stuff with territory, but like once you get to a certain point of intelligence, we don't necessarily, we could think our way out of that. The fact that there are people the fact that there are people on this planet that are saying, hey, maybe war is bad and we shouldn't do it.
That might be one of the filters
right?
where you get past that fighting thing and realize, oh, wait, we can work together. Oh. We just have to figure out how to sort of restructure our brain in such a way.
Yeah.
Is that Star Trek?
Star Trek is... Star Trek is really interesting to me because with the replicators that they've got, or is it replicators? Or fabricators, whatever it is.
Mm.
The stuff that can make matter, essentially. Mm. Or rearrange matter. Look, I know there's going to be Trekkies in the comments telling me that I'm wrong about how it works. It doesn't matter.
Let him be.
Doesn't matter. So they can just make food and clothes and all resources that they want
with these
machines. And so necessarily, money doesn't exist.
I really liked it in the new Doctor Strange movie when one of the lines was, oh, food is free in most universes. It's weird that you have to pay for it.
Yeah. But like,
wow, lefty propaganda in the MCU.
But like, when you think about it, why people are like, oh, well, food is free, the lefty propaganda. Why should we have to pay for a thing that we need to survive?
Yeah, weird, right?
That's very weird. Very strange.
Perform or die.
Yeah, like you gotta engage in this system in order to survive. Oh, so when I engage in this system, I'm doing a necessary thing that will sustain the life of myself and others.
Mm.
Maybe.
No.
What do you mean, maybe? Well, actually, a lot of our work, most of our workers are going to be doing silly little tasks to keep the system running because necessarily we need everyone to be performing tasks in order to give them the food that they need to survive. And we kind of got to the point where, you know, we don't need everyone doing all these tasks in order to sustain everyone, but we still need everyone doing tasks. So we just give silly little tasks to some people. Like the system requires everyone to have a job, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have a job for everyone. So you have people working in marketing or something. Where
that's a fake thing.
That's a made up
thing.
No one
needs that.
That's made up, right? Like,
that's for companies and companies don't exist.
You got investment bankers. It's like, what are you up to? Why are you doing that? What's your deal? You got influencers. Like, why is that
what
a job?
What are we doing?
Why? Like, I honestly, like, if I could have a house and food, I'd do this for free.
Yeah,
I just like what I'm doing. So back to the actual story. They bring up that the sort of main issue after they talk about the sort of here is why it would have to be infected the main issue is that despite believing at the time that the prebiotic soup on Earth was likely also on a good number of other planets, they didn't know whether the conditions were sufficient for life to form over a few billion years. So essentially the issue was one of probability. They believed that there were planets capable of supporting life elsewhere in the universe, but had no idea how likely the formation of life itself actually is. And then sort of this section of the paper is then sort of concluded by this paragraph, which I will read out verbatim. If the probability that life evolves in a suitable environment is low, we may be able to prove that we are likely to be alone in the galaxy. Universe, in brackets. If it is high, the galaxy may be pollulating, never heard that word before, with life of many different forms. Basically, full of life of different forms.
Yeah.
At the moment, we have no means at all of knowing which of these alternatives is correct. We are thus free to postulate that there have been, and still are, many places in the galaxy where life could exist, but that, in at least a fraction of them, after several billion years, the chemical systems had not evolved to the point of self-replication and natural selection. Such planets, if they do exist, would form an excellent breeding ground for external microorganisms. Note that because many, if not all, such planets would have been a reducing atmosphere, they would not be very hospitable to the higher forms of life as we know them on Earth. What they're saying there is that there are different options, right? So if there's a low probability that life evolves in a suitable environment, then you can prove that there aren't any other life forms in the galaxy. Mm. However, if it's high, then there might be lots of different life forms, and we don't know which of these two is the case.
Right.
I mean, we assume that we're more or less alone. At the very least, there we are the only intelligent life that we can make contact with.
Yeah.
There may be microorganisms or something akin to microorganisms somewhere, but we've yet to find that.
Yeah.
But they're saying that because we don't know which of these two it is, we can then just sort of postulate, well, that there could have been lots of places in the galaxy where life could exist, but it just didn't.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got all the conditions that you need for life to start, but over a few billion years, it just didn't kick into gear. But those places would be really good to send microorganisms to populate that planet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If it's got all the right conditions, it just didn't end up happening over time just because of the probability. It's a good environment. Still, you could just send microorganisms and have them do the whole thing. And so I feel like it goes on to make a kind of compelling argument. So they talk about Gould's proposal in 1960 that life on Earth could have evolved from microorganisms left behind incidentally by advanced extraterrestrial life forms, basically smart aliens, which is something I think is pretty interesting. So we can chat a little bit more about that later. But then they go on to talk about the intentional directed panspermia by way of a long-range unmanned spacecraft with the following argument. To show that this is not totally implausible, we shall use the theorem of detailed cosmic reversibility. If we are capable of inventing an as-yet lifeless extrasolar planet, then given the time was available, another technological society might as well have infected our planet when it was still lifeless. Oh. So, obviously that's a fair point, but it's entirely predicated on the existence of another equally technologically advanced society that either no longer exists, has no way of contacting us, or has chosen not to contact us. So, pretty big if to overcome there.
Yeah.
And again, panspermia is just kind of passing the buck to something else, you know?
Again,
it's a similar sort of argument as the simulation theory argument that Elon Musk popularized fairly recently how, like, if there are future civilizations that want to do simulations of their ancestors, and they either choose to do it or they choose not to do it for some reason all the time, consistently they never do it, or they die before they're able to do it. Therefore, the likelihood that you're an ancestor simulation as opposed to a base reality is close to one. And
he's missing some stuff out there.
I'm missing stuff out there as
well. No, I know you are, but Elon Musk is, when he says what he says, is missing some stuff out there.
Yeah. I mean, there's much more detail there, but it's not totally relevant to what we're doing.
No.
It's the same sort of thing of like sort of playing with these ideas of what ifs and probabilities and just saying, well, this is more likely than this thing, and therefore it's probably the case. And it's like, well, there's loads of stuff you're missing out there.
Yeah.
Like, it's infinitely more complex as well.
This is the issue. I feel like if you are smart enough, you can trick people into thinking that anything is more probable than anything else.
It's like tying someone in a little knot.
Yeah, I love doing that, man. I love doing that. Like, that's tying people in little argumentative knots is just so much fun and also so pointless. Like, so the very concept of simulation theory, what do we gain from it? What does it show?
Oh, yeah, it doesn't help you do anything.
No, it's just a way for someone that wants to feel smarter than other people to say, hey, the way that you think the world works. Nah, maybe Ooh. Not.
Somebody in fact, watched The Matrix it's
almost,
times.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost infinitely likely that we're in The Matrix.
Bro.
Otherwise, why would The Matrix film exist? Someone get the Wachowskis on the phone. But but it's so there's this there is this video that I'll link down below by, I think, Sabine Hofstadter or something? I can't remember her name. But she's a YouTuber she's a physicist who makes YouTube videos. Hossenfelder. She's a German theoretical physicist, and she does YouTube videos. And so she did, I think, one on simulation theory. She's pretty solid on a lot of stuff. I tend to watch her videos every now and then, especially when I'm researching for episodes, because she's often got a much more grounded and practical take than the more sort of fanciful YouTubers. She's very grounded, and I think it's interesting because the sort of simulation theory that you're bringing up there, it's definitely interesting. It doesn't add anything to our lives, and if anything, it just makes people scared and worried. Anyway, moving on. So we just spoke about the equally technologically advanced society as us that could potentially have created or sent life to our planet, because we could conceivably do that ourselves. Mm. So it stands to reason that if we are able to do it, if we are able to do it, then it is possible for that to happen.
Yeah.
Right? And if we're saying that, well, it seems really unlikely for life to have propagated itself on Earth, maybe it propagated itself somewhere more where it was more likely to happen.
Right.
And they just sent life to Earth.
Yeah.
Which, like, okay, that's this kind of stuff bothers me, because I don't care how probable it was for life to form on Earth. It did. You know what I mean? You could say, oh, it's incredibly improbable for you to flip a coin and to get 10 heads in a row. But if you did it, then you did it. Like, that, it's not impossible. It's just improbable. Improbable things sometimes happen. Like, I don't know why we're so stuck on the improbability of life forming on Earth, because,
well,
it's possible. There are a ton of planets. It's going to happen on one.
Yeah.
And if you ask, why this one, though? Well, you wouldn't be asking why this one unless you were on this one.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to be this non-existent life form and be asking,
why not this one?
Why not? Like, no. Any life is going to be asking, why this planet?
Yeah.
So
you could point to any empty planet and go, why not that one?
Exactly.
Just because.
Doesn't mean anything.
Just because.
It doesn't mean it. It's like going up to this. It's exactly like walking up to someone else's parents and being like, why not them? What do you mean, why not them?
Well, specifically in the coin toss thing, it's like, if you got 10 heads in a row and you're like, that's really unlikely, therefore there must be some kind of wind god who flipped the coin in such a way that the heads always landed on heads.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I understand,
we have no proof of it, but
that's the only explanation
I understand, but I feel like there are so many little things that people ignore in regards to that. Maybe there's something that I'm missing. Who knows? As I said, it seems fairly likely that another species could exist and do all of this, right? It's not unlikely at the very least. But you then have to prove the existence of that initial society that did that, which again is just passing the buck to something else.
Even that is surely twice as unlikely as us just existing.
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
It's equally as likely.
Okay. Okay, so it's probability multiplied by itself.
Well, I would say, not equally as likely. I would probably say it's about approximately as equally as likely, or more likely, if you assume that the planet that life originated on, first off, was more geared towards starting life, right?
Okay.
So if it was more probable for life to start on another planet, and then they just progressed to this type of society, right? And then they just sent.
But then you have to also factor in the probability that you would send, or that you would send it, because we haven't done it yet.
No, I mean, you don't have to factor in that probability, really, necessarily, because...
Oh, because we know we exist.
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay, fine.
All right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, cool. Probabilities are fun. I want to learn the actual theory behind probability.
I would, but it's just so much. I've looked at it too much.
Okay.
It don't make sense. I mean, they make sense, and then they don't.
It's just so interesting how you think some things will be probabilities, but they're actually givens... And then how to play with it,
Yeah, it's like when you have you've got a certain number of people in the room, I think it's like 20-odd. What's the probability that two of them will have the same birthday?
Almost,
It's like 50% or something.
Yeah, I don't get it.
I mean, I get it. I get it.
Yeah.
But I often have to read the explanation again to get it.
Yeah.
It's like when we talk about game theory.
Yeah.
And we were talking about What was it? Not the prisoner's dilemma.
Changing your answer.
The Monty Hall problem.
That's it.
That's a tough one to wrap your head around, where it feels like, you know. And go check out our game theory episode with Evan Edinger if you'd like to find out more about the Monty Hall problem. But yeah, it's just probability just messes with our heads. I feel like because we're intuitive on a lot of stuff, and then actual probability is not where our intuition lies. But the next section of the paper then goes on to cover the hypothetical spaceship that we could produce, or that could be produced, to send microorganisms across space to other planets. So they said that it would carry a lot of different microorganisms, like algae. It also have CO2 and water and sort of sunlight. They said they could freeze them and then thaw them out. A bunch of other stuff. And they said it wouldn't be necessary to accelerate the spaceship to extremely high velocities, since its time of arrival would not be important. So, I mean, it makes sense, because when you think about this here, a lot of the problems with space travel are the fact that we are often trying to send people. And people are notoriously needy, right? Yeah. You know, they need space to have babies. They need to have food. They need to have water. They need to get rid of their waste.
They're also quite difficult to unfreeze.
Oh, yeah. No, they're actually pretty easy to unfreeze. It's just
keeping them alive.
Is that's a real problem. You know,
they're difficult to freeze in the first place with keeping them alive.
Usually they fight. You know, they fight back when you try to freeze them. They're not happy with that.
Because the cells rupture, but sure.
Can't fight back if your cells are ruptured. No, so, you know, so sending microorganisms gets rid of a lot of the problems, because you can just put them in a sort of tank sort of thing and shoot them off at some speed. You could use ion engines or solar sails or any whatever you want to use, and just have it run for, it said literally for like a million years it could go for, if you wanted. Which, the only issue right now is that we don't necessarily have materials that we think could last for that long in the depth of space. And then also, actually having it land on a planet, I think, would be...
Yeah, without blowing up.
Would be difficult. But there are some technological problems associated with it. And, you know, you got to get all the sort of packaging and stuff right. But it's technically... So here's the little sort of conclusion to that sort of section. We conclude that within the foreseeable future, we could, if we wished, infect another planet. Hence, that is not out of the question that our planet was infected. So it, because bear in mind, you don't need to be alive for this. No one needs to be. You could just send it off and it does its own thing. You know?
If you were ruler of the Earth and you had some space funding,
I'd send it all, yeah.
Yeah, you'd like send like a bunch of them in different directions. Just straight out.
Yeah. No, as many planets as possible, right?
I think it'd be so interesting.
I would send so much. I would, if I was the head of Earth, first, dinosaurs, bring them back.
No.
Yes.
I think that's less important.
Well, you could just, dinosaurs could evolve on another planet if you just send out some life, you know.
They could, but if they're on another planet, it's pointless.
How's he going to get there?
I want a Jurassic Park. I've seen how it goes.
So you have to be able to experience the dinosaurs.
Yeah, obviously. Oh. I think I figured out the problems with Jurassic Park.
Yeah?
They're stupid.
Bold.
They're stupid. Just don't be stupid.
Oh, yeah.
It's very easy. Have nice cages and only employ people that aren't idiots.
Okay.
Jurassic Park solved.
Great.
Oh, and I mean, the thing that took down Jurassic Park was capitalism. So there you go. That tells you something.
Socialist dinosaur utopia.
Yes.
Yeah, it is very interesting in those movies. They're always like, well, life finds a way. As if like you can never contain them because they'll always get out. But it's always down to some stupid person who forgot to do their job.
Well, to be fair, The Life Finds a Way was about them breeding.
Oh, was it?
Because they made them only females.
I thought the subtle implication was they'll find a way.
No, The Life Finds a Way, the T-Rex breaking out of its enclosure they'll because find a someone way to turned take off over,
yeah. Yeah, life did find a way. Stupid person.
Oh, stupid people, okay, right. I guess that's
the
life.
Stupid people are in life as well.
So...
Life finds a way out of the prison.
So they go on to then sort of talk about how it could potentially be possible in the future to send, and I quote, either mice or men or elaborate instruments to the planets of other solar systems, as so often described in science fiction. They also say that it's just always going to be way more effective to send microorganisms because they're way less needy and you can just chuck them at a planet. Conceivably.
Yeah, they might not have the landing issue because you can just, like, as you're approaching the planet, just sort of spew them out and they're not going to break on impact probably because they're so light.
No.
So yeah.
Just, I mean, you could even have it like if it comes towards the planet, shoot a bunch of things. Yeah. At, and then shoot, you know, what I mean, like seed dispersal sort of mechanisms. It's microorganisms are hardy, so it's all good. So, you know, they're essentially saying that microorganisms, because they don't need special equipment to survive, like humans would need gravity and face masks, all that blah. Just send some microorganisms that can survive at very low temperatures and just shoot them out into space. Do it. I think we should. So they do that. They're saying, you know, you could do that with blue-green algae or whatever, and that some of the oldest fossils of microorganisms are blue-green algae, and those are algae that produce their own sort of energy via sort of photosynthesis. And they've said that they occur in essentially, they're estimated to be up to 3.10 to 9 years old. So 3 billion years old makes it improbable that Earth was ever infected merely by higher organisms. And they then go on to ask why someone might do this. So this is a little quote. Next, we must ask what motive we might have for polluting other planets. Since we would not derive any direct advantage from such a program, presumably it would be carried out through either as a demonstration of technological capability or, more probably, through some form of missionary zeal. So I really love papers like this, just a little bit tongue-in-cheek at times, and then speculating on possibilities and using evidence and data to show the potential truth behind sci-fi concepts. Obviously, this is less than convincing, but it is a good read, and one of their points is that if an intelligent race like us, if an intelligent race were like us and came to the conclusion that they were alone in the universe, then they absolutely would send life out to as many planets as possible, which I like as a concept.
Be less lonely.
Yes, cute. We're alone in the universe. Let's just send them out and then just wait billions of years. Hopefully we're still alive, and then if they're still alive, then they'll be like, oh, hey, hello.
Even if we're not alive, they'll carry on.
Exactly.
And also, in the crazy, crazy long term, the sort of DNA that leads to organisms which do that will win the universe. Because if you have, and I know that like decisions like that might not be coded in DNA, they might be vastly more complicated than that. But like we might be in the early stages of the universe where there's not a lot of sort of colonization of the universe. And so there's ample opportunity to do so. And so it's interesting that it says we don't really get anything out of that. As individuals, we don't, but the individuals are only there to propagate the genes, and so the genes do get something out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that it's a really nice idea, because what does it harm? You know? Not that
if there are planets that we crash into with our stuff and we damage the species that are there, then it harms them.
If there's life already there, that's harmful.
But we can't necessarily know where it's going to hit.
Absolutely. No, we can't know. But my point is that if there is, and also realistically, like if there is life on those other planets, there's microorganisms, who cares?
No, but what if it's not? What if it's really big stuff that like introducing, it's like non-carbon based life, and the carbon based life coming in messes with it.
Then that would definitely be problematic. Yeah. I think that'd be a great movie though, wouldn't it? I mean, we basically do that kind of, we do that just with humans.
Oh,
we the baddies.
Yeah, we are the baddies.
Okay. We are definitely the baddies. So although they completely avoid the thing that really winds me up by saying that we've got no idea what the psychology of this hypothetical race is, which is good because, like, as I've said, I just can't stand when people apply flawed and generalized human psychology to some hypothetical or entirely separate group of life forms. And as though our experience is universal or our wants and needs and desires should be shared amongst species. Like, it's just so small-minded, you know, like get out of your, this is why you are facing problems, because you think that the only way that life could exist is if it existed in our image. Just very silly, I think. Then they talk about some biological evidence, which we can go through if you want. It's pretty in-depth. Essentially what they're talking about is the idea that the chemical composition of organisms would reflect to some extent the environment in which they evolved. So if there are organisms that have got really rare sort of elements and compounds in them, then that seems odd, right? So let's say you've got molybdenum, there we go. Gosh, that's such a hard one. You've got molybdenum, which is really not abundant on Earth, but it is relatively more abundant in life forms, in organisms. So you could say that might be, if it was more present on whatever planet they originated from. To me, that seems odd, you know. Life will accumulate things.
It's just
that it
got
needs.
Most of it.
Yeah, life accumulates things that it needs. So that, you know, I mean, I don't know. That's not a very compelling argument to me. I think it's interesting, definitely. There's also the genetic code. They talk about the idea that genetic code is essentially universal, that codons are sort of the basically the way that you translate the individual genetic code into amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. You use essentially codons. Well, a codon is basically just three individual individual sort of units of your DNA. So you've got your A, C, G, and T, right? If you've got, say, A, C, and G, so those three, you would have that would be a codon. And then another combination of three would be another codon, and each codon corresponds to an amino acid or a sort of, I guess, telling the sort of, what's it, the thing that's building the protein to stop.
Yeah.
It doesn't hugely matter what codons are. Essentially, they're just an element. They're just a part of how you code DNA into proteins. So they're pretty consistent across all species. Like, codons are pretty damn consistent. DNA is pretty consistent. If you think about it, we are able to put DNA from ourselves into microorganisms, and they just make it. That is an incredible degree of universal. And take viruses
from,
exist.
And we can take stuff from like a little bacterium and put it in a mouse to make it glow or something like that, can't we?
We can take. Yeah. We can.
So weird.
The fact is, you could take a gene from basically any organism and chuck it into almost any other organism, and they will express those proteins. You know, maybe not. It probably won't work in the same way because there's some way more complex than that. But you can make a. You could make a goat produce spider silk. You could make, you could make organisms produce stuff from other organisms, sort of completely. There is a high degree of sort of universality there, which is interesting, and they're saying that this could be an explanation for that, and that's kind of the whole sort of paper, really. I mean, they go on to have a sort of conclusion which wraps everything up. Which kind of more or less says that this is sketchy. I mean, there's literally a sentence here that says, the arguments we have employed here are, of necessity, somewhat sketchy. So, essentially, they're saying that, look, it's sketchy, but maybe we should look into this. It's an interesting idea. I mean, the very last paragraph. One further point deserves emphasis. We feel strongly that under no circumstances should we risk infecting other planets at the present time. It would be wise to wait until we know far more about the probability of the development of life on extrasolar planets before causing terrestrial organisms to escape from the solar system. So they're saying, look, this is a possibility. It's sketchy, we know, but it's not completely improbable.
Yeah.
But also, this is really dangerous, so we probably shouldn't do it. So
Corey did not heed that last bit.
I don't care, man. I don't care. I think it's a. If we know that there are uninhabited planets that could sustain life, I don't think it's a bad idea to just chuck some life on there.
But see what happens.
It's our bloody universe. Yeah. We are the universe. We can do what we want. Why shouldn't we do that?
Who's going to care?
Who's going to care?
No one's gonna
Who
care.
Does it harm? No one. Do it. Go for it. I don't want to come off as though I could be willy-nilly on safety when it comes to science. You know, like, I'll say I'll make a Jurassic Park, but that's because, again, problem with Jurassic Park, capitalism. We should not limit ourselves from doing things because we feel too, about it. Like, that makes me uncomfortable, the thought of it. Yeah, but why? Is it going to bring harm to anyone? Well, no, not really. I just don't like, well, then do it. Do it. Oh, maybe we shouldn't be using embryos and stem cells. No, do it. I don't care. Do it. Maybe we shouldn't be genetically altered. If you're going to help people, do it. With people's full consent, if you're not altering their germline, if you're not altering things down the line for their kids, do it. Man, honestly, like, I just, this sort of hand-wringing and, should we, maybe it's dangerous. Do it if it's not dangerous, you know? I mean, obviously, it's much more complicated when it comes to seeding life on other planets, but hey, man, I'm okay with that. Generally, I mean, we're trying to chuck ourselves to Mars, so, like, why not, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the entire sort of Crick and Orgel panspermia sort of story. And I've kind of got two more questions. One, does it hold water? I'm going to answer that. Not really.
It's not glass.
No, it's not glass, no. But the Earth does hold water. A lot of water.
The Earth is not glass.
Quite a lot.
More water than anything else on the planet, actually.
Than any glass I know of.
Yeah.
Proportionally, no. The Earth is 70% water. Glass can be 100% water.
A glass literally, can be
90% water.
So
what a stupid conversation.
So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea, but we kind of spoke about this. It's mostly based on probability and a lot of assumptions, and it could be the case, but I don't think anyone's actually sitting there thinking this. Yeah, this is how life formed. We've got better ideas, and again, it's just kind of passing the buck to another planet.
You do it.
Yeah, this planet did it.
Yeah.
But how did it do it? It had some special things that made it do it. It's the God argument all over again. But I mean, I've just got one last question, which is, should we infect other planets with life? What do you think?
I don't know all the logistics, but I think probably yes.
I think if we've got a planet where we're like certain there's nothing,
yeah,
there's nothing there, it's just barren, then yeah.
If we think it's likely to sustain life and there's no life there that we can tell.
Fun experiment.
Why not?
I just feel like if it's not going to harm anything, we're not going to gain from it, but why not? Why not give those microorganisms that chance to populate that new environment and just see what happens?
I guess we might have a space war, though.
Oh, with it way in the future.
With them, yeah.
When they want independence eventually.
Yeah. Well, no, we won't. We'll leave them to be independent.
Oh, okay.
Will we, though?
Very good.
Do you trust our track record on that?
If I was president of the king of the world,
it would be like a parent-child relationship. It'd be like, I gave you life. You have to work for me.
You mean an Australia UK relationship?
Yeah, sure.
Do you maybe want to do a little quiz for our quiz?
Panspermia edition.
So the quick fire quiz is the same as always. I'll ask one question for the two of you. The first person buzzing with the correct answer after finish asks the question wins. What do they win, Jam?
Some pansperm.
Pansperm?
Yeah.
Oh, what's that? Some
sperm straight from the pan.
Delicious.
Sounds good. That's the way
hot.
I like it.
Piping hot.
So what is your buzzer, Luke? Very good, Jan. What is your buzzer?
What is that?
That's life forming.
No.
That makes sense. That's exactly how it sounds.
Does it?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the question is, what is the etymology of the word panspermia? Luke?
Ancient Greek.
Yeah, but what? Well, we gotta
seed.
Right, but what are the Greek words?
Panspermia.
I forgot this bit.
No. Pansperma.
Yes, very good.
First time.
Well done. You win some sperm. Right.
Hooray!
From the pan.
Oh, I've been hot. Delicious protein.
I thought you were bringing the sperm from the pan. I thought that was your goal.
I didn't provide the pan or the sperm. I'm sorry.
Goodness me. Well, we'll get you that pan of sperm. Don't you worry. But until then, we would like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you, executive producers Danito and Rosa Rodriguez. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCore everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Goodbye.